We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. When India and Pakistan demonstrated their nuclear capabilities back in 1998, that worried many people. It worried them because there had been a history of conflict between the two nations, and they worried that any future conflict could escalate to the level of a nuclear exchange. There are some people who make the argument, however, that the presence of these weapons on both sides have actually prevented the outbreak of war, but others say that tensions between these two countries do remain high and could easily spin out of control. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the issue of nuclear stability in South Asia, and we have two guests, both of them joining us by telephone. Sumit Ganguly is the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's also a professor of political science there. And S. Paul Kapoor is an associate professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. Before that, he served on faculties of the Naval War College and Claremont McKenna College, and also was visiting professor at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. Both of them follow the politics of this region, have written on it, and the two together are the co-authors of a recent book that's titled India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. It is published by Columbia University Press, has come out recently, and so is in the bookstore, in the library, if you're interested in reading it. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's for local folks. If it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we also have the possibility of email if you'd like to send along your comments that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Ganguly, hello.
Hello.
And Professor Kapoor. Thank you both very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it. But perhaps we just can recap, and I don't know, maybe one or the other of you or both, but just comment on, at this point, what is the nuclear capability, what are the nuclear capabilities of India and Pakistan? Professor Ganguly, maybe I might just ask you to do that, and if Professor Kapoor would like to add on, you can do that then.
Right. The exact estimates obviously are classified, but on the other hand, based upon what's available in the public domain, it's widely believed that India possesses about 60 deliverable nuclear weapons and Pakistan close to 100. Pakistan's program has been a dedicated nuclear weapons program. India's nuclear program really started out as a civilian nuclear program, and then part of it was spun off into a military program. That, in large part, explains why Pakistan has more weapons. Both sides possess long-range bombers, which can deliver nuclear weapons, and they also have ballistic missiles on which nuclear warheads can be installed. India is in the process of trying to build a nuclear submarine, but is still some distance away from it. But Paul may want to augment what I already said.
No, I agree with that. That sounds right. But they're both moving forward with their programs, and India, in fact, is moving towards being able to put together a triad along the lines of what the United States had during the Cold War, which was sort of a three-legged approach, putting weapons on missiles, submarines, and bombers. That's something that they don't have yet, but they're moving in that direction. Mm.
And maybe let me ask you, and again, then Professor Ganguly, you might want to comment on this. Is the nuclear component to the arsenals of these countries, is this something where there is wide popular support? That is, do the people of India and the people of Pakistan think that it is important that their nations have nuclear weapons?
Yes, they are. They do enjoy wide popular support. Part of the picture here that one has to understand is that these are countries that have a colonial history and nuclear weapons for them are strategically important, but they also have great symbolism in the sense that they allow these countries to sort of step forward into, arguably at least, the first rank of nations in a strategic or military sense. And so there's sort of a dual component to it.
And I'm certain that it is the case that people on both sides, that is people of India and people of Pakistan, would feel that if the other country had the weapons, it would be essential that their country did as well.
No question at all. And in fact, when India tested in 1998, it really left Pakistan with no choice but to test, even if Pakistani leaders maybe were ambivalent about it at some level. There was just, as a political matter, there was absolutely no option.
Professor Ganguly, anything you might want to add to that?
No, I don't disagree with Paul's characterization. I think that's exactly right. The only thing I would add is that in India, there is a bit of a debate about the utility and the desirability of possessing nuclear weapons. There is a small but not terribly significant anti-nuclear community in India, composed of journalists, composed of people who still have a kind of a Gandhian outlook and who feel a certain moral abhorrence to nuclear weapons. But they are nowhere near being in the policy-making circles.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in having you both talk a little bit about the approaches that you take in the book to this subject, and I'll start with Professor Ganguly. And it is my understanding that the argument that you're making here, it seems much the same as people have argued elsewhere, that if you have two sides here where there is the potential for conflict, both of them have the nuclear capability, then the fact that they both do tends to offset. And so that in fact, some people say, well, that's that creates instability. Other people seem to make this argument that says, well, the fact that both sides have them makes it less likely then that either side would use them.
I think your characterization of both positions is extremely accurate and very concise. And I actually happen to take one of those two positions, and that is that nuclear weapons do produce this kind of stabilizing effect. And I believe that it is the case also in the subcontinent, as it was during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, especially after both sides managed to develop secure second strike forces. And I think over time, India and Pakistan will move towards that position. Already, I think a form of rough and ready stability exists on the subcontinent because neither side has the capability of carrying out what in strategic studies is called a decapitating first strike, where you effectively take care of the other side's nuclear weapons and thereby do not fear retaliation. Neither side can be so confident at this stage. And over time, I think this lack of confidence in a decapitating first strike will become increasing, and thereby make the arsenals more secure. There are one or two possibilities by which this stability might be disturbed, and towards the end we can talk about this. This is an area where Paul and I actually happen to agree about how certain technological developments, especially if they are pursued vigorously by one or both sides, could have destabilizing consequences. But for the time being and for the foreseeable future, I think the possibilities of war, let alone nuclear war, are actually quite small in the region because of the stabilizing effect of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, then let me turn to Professor Kapoor, as I think the argument that you're making is that these weapons are potentially destabilizing. The fact that we haven't had serious conflict with the potential to escalate doesn't mean that we couldn't have it. And it sounds as if the point that you're making is that the presence of these weapons are dangerous and are not helpful.
Well, I would say that we actually have had some pretty serious conflicts with the potential to escalate. They haven't escalated beyond a certain point, but I think it's wrong to assume that because it hasn't happened so far, it couldn't happen in the future. And actually, if one looks carefully at those crises, I think the evidence indicates pretty strongly that the reason they drew down was not mainly because of nuclear weapons, but for other reasons. My argument essentially is that the acquisition of nuclear weapons can actually create incentives for dangerous behavior on the part of states that are dissatisfied with the current state of affairs and also relatively weak at the conventional level. So if you get a state that is conventionally weak and unhappy with the status quo, with the current situation, nuclear weapons do a couple of things. One is that they afford that state a shield, essentially, behind which to challenge the status quo in ways that can be dangerous and destabilizing, because at the end of the day, that state with nuclear weapons knows that its adversaries are limited in what they can do. So a state like Pakistan knows that even though India is conventionally stronger, there are limits to what India can do in retaliation, given the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons. And the other thing that happens is that the fact that the crises then turn into nuclearized crises attracts international diplomatic attention, which can be useful to those weaker states that are trying to get international intervention in the problems and crises and disputes that they care about. And so that's the sort of behavior that I think we've seen in South Asia, and potentially one could see it elsewhere in the world.
Well, and are there some examples of particularly provocative behavior on the part of the government of Pakistan that you would cite as an example of this?
Well, I think it's clear that over the course of the development of Pakistan's nuclear weapons capability, the Pakistani government became emboldened to push the envelope, if you will, in places like Kashmir, which were long disputed between India and Pakistan, and about which Pakistan was deeply unhappy. The Pakistanis are unhappy with the territorial division in Kashmir and would like to change that. But the truth, the on-the-ground truth was that the Indians were sufficiently strong conventionally that the Pakistanis really couldn't do much about this without facing the possibility of catastrophic defeat. But acquiring nuclear weapons enabled them to push harder on this and know that the Indians really couldn't come after them with everything that they had because of that nuclear shield. And Pakistani behavior became more provocative. And what you see if you look at the data on conflict between the two countries is that crises between India and Pakistan during the nuclearization process become more frequent, and they also become more serious.
Mm. Well, Professor Ganguly, I wonder what you think about that and whether you agree that during this period that we're talking about, since the development of nuclear weapons, that Pakistan has engaged in behavior that was, say, more provocative than it had been before.
Part of the problem is that this also coincides with certain developments in India which made it possible for Pakistan to fish in troubled waters. I specifically refer to the outbreak of an insurgency in Kashmir, which largely stemmed from the shortcomings of India's policies towards its only Muslim majority state, which contributed ultimately to an uprising, a local uprising, in December 1989, early 1990. And this is about the time also when Pakistan had proceeded to acquire at least a rudimentary nuclear weapons capability. So we are faced with a kind of a conflation of factors yes, there is no question that Pakistan's behavior has become much more provocative in the wake of its possession, even the rudimentary possession of nuclear weapons, but this also coincided with an opportunity to fish in troubled waters. That there was an opportunity to meddle because the conditions were particularly ripe for meddling, and thereby the Pakistanis jumped into the fray. So we don't really know for a certainty whether it was the possession of nuclear weapons that led them to engage in provocative behavior, or whether simply greater opportunities were afforded because the Indians helped create a rather unfortunate situation in this disputed state. So finding the exact sort of causal link here between what led to more provocative behavior on the part of the Pakistanis is somewhat difficult. That said, I'm willing to concede that given the nature of various regimes in Pakistan, it's probable that they became a bit more emboldened by their possession of nuclear weapons. But one wonders if the conditions were not appropriate, would they have behaved more provocatively? And the jury, frankly, is out.
Let me introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus. Sumit Ganguly is professor of political science at Indiana University, Bloomington. And S. Paul Kapoor is associate professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He's also faculty affiliate at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. They both follow the politics of the subcontinent and have co-authored a book, India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. It's published by the Columbia University Press. Questions are welcome. We have one ready to go, and others can call in. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You may also send along your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Nearby community of Belgium is up here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Let me preface what I'm going to ask and say here by saying that I really am not pro-nuclear weapons, but at the same time, there's an aspect of this that just baffles the imagination. Nuclear weapons are very expensive to build, they're very expensive to maintain, and they're very expensive to get rid of. And the only time they've been used in war is, pretty close to 60 years ago now, and we were the people who used them. And our use of them cast us in a very negative light throughout the world. Now, it seems that nobody is really ever going to use nuclear weapons again because of all the complications involved with them. So why do we keep pursuing them?
I think it's an interesting question. Maybe I'll toss it to both guests. Let me start with Professor Kapoor, because I think that a lot of people would make that argument that the caller makes, that in practical military terms, and for all of the reasons that the caller laid out, that nuclear weapons really don't make much sense. Why would anybody want to go to all of the trouble and expense of developing them?
I'll say a couple of things on that. First is that it's true that they're expensive. One thing to keep in mind is, though, that they are cheaper than people. they don't have to be educated, fed. You don't have to take care of their medical needs. You don't have to give them pensions when they retire. So actually, despite the fact that they cost quite a bit, they're cheaper than conventional forces in some ways. That said, that's not to deny the fact that there's a huge investment required, especially for developing countries like India and Pakistan. So one wonders why would they bother to do this. There's a debate out there about why states acquire nuclear weapons, and there's not really consensus in the strategic community about it. Some people think that it's a straight-up strategy argument along the lines that Schumann has been making, that you know, nuclear weapons provide you with the ultimate deterrent, and once you have them, at least a second-strike capability, you can be quite confident that your state is never going to face catastrophic defeat. And so that's why countries pursue them. In states like India and Pakistan, they live in dangerous parts of the world, and so it would make sense that they would go down this route. Another argument is sort of a norms-based argument, which argues that states acquire these things because they've become part of what it means to be a powerful country. The caller pointed to the other side of this argument, which is that there's a real sort of prohibition against using them and real normative problems with having or even or thinking about using them. But on the other hand, there's a power element to it, and states that want to be seen as powerful, maybe post-colonial states that have been colonized in the past, dominated in the past, want to make sure it doesn't happen again and want to make a statement about it and be part of a community of powerful states, and so that's why they pursue them. Another argument is a domestic politics argument, bureaucratic argument. Maybe you have a strategic community, scientific communities that want to pursue these things for their own ends, military communities within states. And so they pursue them even though it's not in the best interest of the state at large. So there are debates about this in the larger literature. These debates have been applied to South Asia. Different people take different positions. I think really a combination of the strategic and the normative argument makes the most sense in the South Asian case. I think there's no way to deny that, again, given the danger of the neighborhood in which these countries live, having a deterrent like nuclear weapons really makes sense for them. The Indians worry a lot about China, and they also worry about Pakistan at some level as well. Not perhaps in the same way, but it makes sense for them to be able to have a deterrent capability like that. And then the normative side of it is important to them as well. It's important to be able to say, hey, You know, we have these things. These are not weapons just for Westerners. These are weapons that even a country like India can have. And it's an important statement in terms of domestic politics and also internationally.
Hmm. Professor Ganguly, anything you want to add?
No, I really don't disagree with that characterization. And I think Paul has very fairly summarized the state of the debate, that those are the reasons why states pursue nuclear weapons, even at considerable initial cost. But as he also correctly underscored, that once you build these things and you have some way of testing even components thereof, you're assured that they will work when the time comes. And God forbid that the time will never come. But on the other hand, you want to be certain that the designs that you have made will work in the event of a terrible contingency. So I think his characterization, both generally of why states acquire nuclear weapons and why India and Pakistan went ahead and acquired them, even at considerable cost. And by the way, we shouldn't speak simply of India and Pakistan in the same breath. The Indian economy can sustain defense expenditures to a much greater extent than Pakistan. India is growing at about 8 to 9% annually, and consequently the drag that defense expenditures or even expenditure on nuclear weapons have on India are considerably smaller than the effects on Pakistan.
Mm.
And we should constantly bear this in mind because of the fundamental asymmetry in capabilities between these two countries.
Mm. The criticism that's often leveled at nuclear powers around the world is that they have far more weapons than they really need. Professor Ganguly said that you thought that at this point we think that India has maybe about 60 and Pakistan has perhaps close to 100. That would seem to be certainly sufficient on both sides. Are there people in those two governments, is there anyone that's saying, all right, that's enough, we don't need to make any more? Or are these, in both cases, are they pretty solidly ongoing programs with no sort of ceiling in mind as to how many weapons they really need to have?
Right. There is a real disjunction here, particularly in India, between the more thoughtful people who do advocate for nuclear weapons, but at the same time want to develop what in the strategic literature is called a finite deterrent capability, that just the possession of a small, secure force carefully dispersed across the country is more than adequate. But unfortunately, because of a sort of a bureaucratic, scientific, and technological momentum, India is inexorably proceeding towards a much wider and a much larger arsenal than what I deem is really necessary for them to feel secure both against Pakistan and China, which I deem to be most unfortunate, the pathway that they are embarked upon, because I think they're going to make the same mistakes that we and the Soviets did during the Cold War and developed esoteric doctrines to justify an extraordinarily large nuclear force. I don't think they'll ever quite build the kinds of forces that we had or the Soviets had, but they will build a force well beyond any kind of strategic necessity. Of course, in Pakistan, unfortunately, there is very little debate about force structure, in large part because very few people understand the nature of nuclear forces, and also the program is disproportionately dominated by the military, and consequently they can divert almost any resources they want to the nuclear weapons program, which they sort of consider to be their crown jewels. Mm-hmm. So I also worry a great deal about the investments that Pakistan is making well beyond any kind of strategic necessity. And to some degree, there is an element of an arms race here, because when the Pakistanis see the Indians acquire certain kinds of capabilities, they feel they must at least match the Indians, not weapon for weapon, but at least in some fashion, so that they have at least similar capabilities, if not identical capabilities.
Right. Well, let's go on and talk with someone else. Here's a caller here in Champaign County, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to start by saying that the assertion made earlier that nuclear weapons have only been used once and by us is just not true. The use of nuclear weapons is just as a loaded gun can be pointed at somebody's head. And the U.S. has blatantly used nuclear weapons nine or so times through history, as chronicled by Ellsberg. And there's another thing that's been sort of in the discourse here was the idea of the belligerent Pakistan. Now, someone did just refer to elements in India that are have different reasons, et cetera. Well, the Hindu fundamentalist group who were in power for a while has elements that are extremely belligerent, and particularly when goaded in a cycle of escalation by Pakistan elements, could easily. I mean, the scenario that nuclear weapons are holding the peace, I think, is undermined by that point of view as well. So there's a lot just in that. But I wanted you to screw up your courage and talk about the U.S. role in the circumstance too, because the U.S. all along, when Reagan was helping Pakistan build the bomb, and now that I don't know whether the argument is made by Indian politicians behind doors that, you know, this is the obligation for us throwing the nuclear treaty up in the air and aiding them in their quote-unquote civilian program. So I know that's always hard to talk about. It seems it doesn't come up early in the show for some reason, but please address those if you would.
All right. Well, maybe I'll pick Professor Kapoor to start, and then Professor Ganguly, you can comment. Can you talk about the United States, its involvement with both countries, whether or not the United States was involved in providing assistance for them to develop their nuclear programs, and so forth?
Well, the United States has tried to discourage both sides from acquiring nuclear weapons. That said, as the caller pointed out, the United States ignored especially Pakistan's progress towards a nuclear capability during the 1980s for larger strategic reasons, because the Pakistanis were helping us with what was going on in Afghanistan. So we turned a blind eye to the Pakistani program and their progress on it. Eventually, sanctions were instituted, and there was a lot of pressure put on both sides by the United States and the non-proliferation regime. There were, good and bad points to it. The bad point was really that it didn't stop either side from acquiring weapons, and there were costs in terms of our bilateral relationships with both countries. In the Pakistani case, we lost contact with really a generation of Pakistani strategic thinkers and military officers and so on during that time. On the Indian side, the U.S. Relationship, the Indo-U.S. relationship, really took a serious hit. And relations between India and the United States were frosty during the Cold War for a whole lot of reasons, but a big part of it was the non-proliferation efforts on the part of the United States. And that continued. It still continues, although the nuclear deal, the recent Indo-U.S. nuclear deal, I think has helped that a little bit. That deal makes available nuclear technology and materials to India, despite the fact that India is not a signatory to the NPT. There's big debate about that. We can get into it if people are interested. I think that it's kind of that deal is sort of a mixed bag. It clearly undermines some of the incentives to join the NPT as a non-nuclear weapons state, because it allows India the benefits of joining the NPT regime, namely access to nuclear technologies and materials, without actually doing it. And essentially turns India into a de facto nuclear state. So that's the bad part. The good part, I think, is that it improves Indo-U.S. relations, and there are a lot of synergies, strategic synergies between the United States and India that were really progress on those was being blocked over the nuclear issue. And the fact is that India is and was a nuclear power. It's going to be. It's not going to give up those weapons. So in some ways, the deal is just recognizing reality. And removing a roadblock to useful cooperation between the two countries. So it's a close call. I think reasonable people can disagree on it. I come down on the side of being in favor of it, but I recognize that there's some some non-proliferation concerns as well.
Well, that's, let me turn to Professor Gongoli and have him follow up on that same point, because I think there are certainly people who would make that argument, that they would say that the way we've, this relationship that Professor Kapoor was talking about here between India and the United States, doesn't that really call into question the commitment of the United States government to non-proliferation?
I really don't think so. Even though a great deal of ink has been spilled on this particular subject, for the very simple reason that, for the very simple reason that India actually has a fairly robust non-proliferation record, with the exception of the diversion of some spent fuel from a Canadian reactor, which did not formally violate a law. It may have violated the spirit of the agreement, but it did not violate any international legal obligations. India has not engaged in any form of proliferation. In fact, it has an impeccable record on this particular subject. And also, one can keep harping to India to join the non-proliferation treaty. This is rather pointless. It's really not going to happen, because there is a firm consensus in India that this is an unequal and unfair treaty, and it does not place any real obligations to proceed towards disarmament on the part of the nuclear weapons powers. Consequently, it made sense to at least partially bring India into a legal regime through a bilateral agreement with the United States, so that at least a segment of India's nuclear program is now under full-scope International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards. So I actually wholeheartedly support the U.S.-India nuclear deal. But to go back to two issues that your caller raised, one was about the American use of nuclear weapons. We actually did use them twice, not once, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, both as part and parcel of ending the same war, but we did, in fact, use them twice. Subsequently, of course, we have resorted to nuclear threats on a number of occasions during the Cold War. But that's not, in formal terms, that's not really the use of nuclear weapons, because they were not actually detonated, though we threatened the use of nuclear weapons, and on occasion these threats worked. On certain occasions, our bluff was called. So that's one issue. As far as Hindu fundamentalists are concerned, on an issue of terminology, and this is not trivial, one really shouldn't use the term Hindu fundamentalist, because Hinduism has no fundamentals. So you can talk about Hindu fanatics, you can talk about Hindu chauvinists, but it really is a contradiction in terms to talk about Hindu fundamentalists. No such entity or individual or organization exists, because Hindus can't agree on one sacred book or one sacred temple where they all worship. In this regard, Hinduism is very different from the faiths that originated in the Middle East. and also, they are out of power. India remains a robust democracy. They're now licking their wounds, and there is no imminent danger of the BJP, the Hindu right-wing party, coming to power anytime in the foreseeable future.
We are coming now into our last 15 minutes, and I would like to introduce again, we're past our midpoint, introduce again our guest. For anyone who has just tuned in, Sumit Ganguly is professor of political science. He holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations and is director of research at the Center on American and Global Security at Indiana University, Bloomington. S. Paul Kapoor is associate professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He's also faculty affiliate at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation. Together, they are the co-authors of the recent book, India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, and it's published by Columbia University Press. 333-9455, our local number here, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the relationship now between the Obama administration, particularly in the Indian government, and the administration's interest in India. You, the two of you together, wrote a piece that was published about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, in Foreign Affairs, talking about India and the U.S., noting that both the Clinton and the Bush administrations had been trying to improve relations between India and the United States. And here in this piece, you're making the argument that at least to that point, it seemed that India was not a particular priority for the Obama administration. Certainly recently, we have seen a great deal of concentration on Pakistan because of our involvement in Afghanistan. Is it still the case that, I'll pick up Professor Kapoor, you can go first, and then we'll go to Professor Ganguly. Is it still the case now that the Obama administration is just not particularly interested in India?
I don't know whether it's fair to say that they're uninterested in India, and I think that recently they've been making efforts to improve on what happened in the first part of the administration. I think the sense in India, and it's not without some justification, is that there's been a real decline since the Bush administration. There was recognition that there was little possibility that the relationship was going to return to the heady days of the Bush years, with things like the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal, big ticket items like that. There's also a concern that things are going downhill fast and maybe in some ways will be irreparable. What are the concerns? Well, one of them is that the United States is now more interested in working with China instead of working together with India. The Bush people were leaned in the direction of trying to contain China, and the strategic relationship with India, I think, was part of that approach. But now the Obama administration has leaned in the direction of working more closely with China and paying less attention to the strategic relationship with India. Another concern, nonproliferation. The Obama administration is much more dedicated to a robust international nonproliferation regime than was the Bush administration. As we mentioned earlier, nonproliferation in India is really a non-starter. The Indians see the regime as really a system of inequality that was foisted on the world by the Western powers, and they want no part of it. Another problem that they see with the Obama administration is that the Obama people coddle Pakistan, if you will. They're too concerned with Pakistani interests, and they're too willing to promote those interests in an effort to ensure U.S. success in Afghanistan. The Indians believe that the Pakistanis are actually fooling the Americans and really working against American and Indian interests as well in Afghanistan. So those are their concerns. I think there have been some improvements lately. You've seen the strategic, U.S.-India strategic dialogue. There's been noises about certain things that the Indians care about a great deal, like U.N. Security Council membership and so on. But I don't know that the recent atmospherics have been enough really to change the way the Indians feel about the Obama administration. I think there's a fair bit of pessimism there.
Hmm. Well, Professor Ganguly, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that the Obama administration initially did not pay enough attention to India. They were dragging their feet in terms of implementing the terms of the nuclear deal that had been arrived at under the Bush administration. And as Paul correctly points out, that they sought a better relationship with the People's Republic of China. But after the manner in which President Obama was greeted in Beijing, I think that gave the Obama administration some pause. Nevertheless, they are still not pursuing a containment strategy of China, but they have warmed up to India to some degree. The U.S.-India strategic dialogue has been set in motion. It was held in early June of this year in Washington, D.C., and I think there is a greater level of comfort in both capitals with each other. Also, the president is scheduled to visit India in November, and the Indians are anxiously awaiting his visit. I hope that during that time, certain important deals will be consummated, which are currently in the works. And I think the Indians are also hoping that will happen. For example, there is a nuclear liability bill in the Indian Parliament, which the U.S. is watching very closely, because unless that bill passes, American nuclear investors cannot go into the Indian market because they are formally prohibited by American law. So much remains in abeyance, but the same attention that was accorded to India by the Bush administration simply has not been matched by the Obama administration, despite their efforts to repair some of the initial damage of the first year of the Obama administration.
Mm. Something that I'd like to have you both talk about, seems that we perhaps should have raised the question a little bit earlier, but I'm interested in having you both talk a little bit about the relationship between, generally the relationship between India and Pakistan, something where we know that there is a long history of conflict. And in recent years, and by recent, I guess, maybe I mean in the last 5 to 10, there have been attempts by the two governments to reach out, and perhaps there have been small steps that indicate an improvement of the relationship, although then, having said that, then something will come along and that there have been major setbacks. So sometimes it seems you take a couple of steps forward and then you end up taking a big step back. And again, here maybe I'll start with Professor Kapoor and ask you, just can you talk a little bit about right at the moment where the relationship between the two countries, between the two governments stand?
Well, the relationship is better than it has been, but you know the bad relations go back really to the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947. Moving forward, created a lot of bad blood and memories. The two countries have fought four wars, mainly over the territory of Kashmir, and the Pakistanis have waged an asymmetric warfare campaign against India, essentially, which has used non-state actors, terrorists, if you will, to try to undermine the status quo in Kashmir, and then also to launch attacks actually on India proper. And you know, the relationship has gone up and down. It seems very bleak times and some better ones. Recently, things seem to be on track with a peace process between the two sides. The situation in Kashmir was improving. Violence was down. But the Mumbai attacks set things back a great deal, and the peace process was put off, put on hold. And you know, the problem is that even as things improve, the situation is sort of hostage to the next crisis that happens, and the next crisis is not necessarily in the control of either India or Pakistan. So one problem that exists and that Schumann and I have talked about and written about is the fact that the groups that Pakistan has nurtured over the decades, really, to do their bidding in this asymmetric conflict now are not completely within their control, and they have an agenda that's more robust than the Pakistani government. And again, they're not fully within the control of the Pakistani government or even the security services that previously had operated them. So, you know, you can get a situation where there's a catastrophic terrorist attack or something like that on India, not, you know, orchestrated by Pakistan, but the Indians will have little choice but to hold Pakistan responsible. And although in the past they've been able to stay their hand, it may not be politically feasible next time. That's happening even as the Indians are going through some military doctrinal innovations and acquiring a greater conventional capability so that the next time something like this happens, they'll really be able to punish Pakistan. So it makes for a dangerous situation, one in which the relations have improved, but I think the Manmohan Singh government, for instance, is not interested in, you know, continued conflict with Pakistan and really sees job number one as economic development and realizes that there's a huge opportunity cost to continued conflict. But at the same time, the improvements in relations are really held hostage to an environment in which, or a terrorist campaign or an asymmetric warfare campaign that's been created over the decades, in which now nobody can really fully control or stop. So it's a dangerous situation.
Well, that may, Professor Gangule, that indeed makes it sound that perhaps they, as if the question to ask is not so much who wants good relations between the two countries as it is who is interested in not having good relations between the two countries.
Right. In India, there is a segment of the population, particularly spearheaded by the BJP, that really doesn't care very much about good relations with Pakistan. They would even settle for a cold peace with Pakistan. Though even within the BJP, there are important divisions. There are some who would prefer outright hostility towards Pakistan, and some who would settle for a cold peace with Pakistan. Within Pakistan, I'm afraid, the military still remains unreconciled to peace with India. General Kiani has publicly stated that India remains the principal threat to Pakistan. He doesn't consider the domestic threat that he faces to be of greater significance, even though it's costing Pakistan blood and treasure practically every day of the week, with repeated bombings and terrorist attacks, even in major cities of Pakistan, including in the heartland of the Punjab, in the capital city of Lahore, the capital of the Punjab, Pakistan's most powerful and prosperous province. So in Pakistan, I'm afraid the peace constituency is much smaller, and President Zardari is really not the master of his own house. And most recently, Zardari said something utterly fatuous, even on the eve of talks with India. In an interview with Newsweek magazine, he stated that he really felt that there was no one in India who was prepared to come forward and talk to him, and more importantly, recognize that terrorism was a menace that really was haunting both countries. This was an utterly disingenuous and foolish statement on his part. And when you have a elected leader making statements like this in the face of repeated efforts on the part of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to reach out to Pakistan, even after a series of terrorist attacks have been traced back to Pakistani soil, whether or not there was actual connivance of the Pakistani government in these terrorist attacks, nevertheless, intelligence intercepts, electronic intercepts clearly show that these attacks emanated from Pakistan. Even in the face of that, and faced with opposition from his cabinet colleagues, Prime Minister Singh has tried to continue the peace process. And then he's greeted with a statement like this in a magazine of international repute. This is not a particularly helpful way to proceed. So I'm afraid I'm a little more pessimistic about the prospects of improving Indo-Pakistani relations at the present juncture than Paul is.
Well, let me ask you, Professor Kapoor, do you think that the United States, that the world has reason to be concerned about the stability of the government of Pakistan?
Well, sure. That's sort of a perennial problem. Pakistan's a Praetorian state. The military has dominated it really since the outset. There have been interludes of nominally civilian rule, as we have now, but really behind the scenes, it's the military and the security services that hold the reins of power. When the military tires of the civilian government, they've gotten rid of it, and so there's the question of. And that's obviously not a good thing. We prefer to see civilian rule there for all sorts of reasons, both normatively and because civilian governments tend to do better at a lot of the things that we care about. We'd like to see more emphasis on domestic development, economic improvement, and so on, rather than continued conflict with India, continued support for terrorism, and so on. One hopes that a civilian government would be more likely to pursue those ends. So at that level, one always worries about stability. There's a larger stability question, which is that even the military is still a fairly conservative institution, not given, I think, to sort of radical doctrines and so on, although there may be elements within it. But by and large, the people that control the military are a fairly stable and predictable bunch, which is one of the reasons why the United States has sort of dealt with them, sort of gritted their teeth and dealt with them over the years and continues to do so. What's the likelihood of that sort of establishment being overthrown by some sort of a more radical Islamist element? I think the likelihood of that is sometimes exaggerated. The military has a pretty firm grip on power there, despite the fact that militants and Islamists are challenging the state for control in certain areas. The core of the Pakistani state, the nuclear establishment, the military, and so on, I think is pretty firmly under the grip of the establishment. So, it's kind of a mixed picture.
Mm. We're just about the point where we have to finish. I have one caller here. I'd like to try to give them a quick chance to comment on cell phone line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to enhance one comment made by Professor Ganguly about Hindu fundamentalism. I think the Hindu fundamentalism does not exist, mainly because Hinduism's fundamental principle is very liberal, and that is the reason why there are so many thoughts of in Hindu religion permissible from all the way to from monotheism to non-believing in God. So it's not because we do not agree on our principle. Our principle is extremely liberal. That's why there is no fundamentalism. Thank you.
All right. Professor Ganguly, anything you'd want to add to that?
No, I stand by what I said. I have a pretty good grasp of this subject, even though I'm not a believer myself. I actually have done some serious reading and took courses in college on Hinduism. So I stand by what
All
I
right.
said.
Well, there we're going to have to finish. We've come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, Sumit Ganguly. He's holds the Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations and is also Director of Research at the Center on American and Global Security, Indiana University, Bloomington. Professor Ganguly, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
And S. Paul Kapoor, he is Associate Professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. And Professor Kapoor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if you're interested in reading up on the subject we've been discussing, you might want to take a look at their book, India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. And it is published by Columbia University Press.